Good morning. So it's a truism in Zen that we can learn and should learn to live in the moment. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit today. I'm going to talk about the shadow side of that truism, and then I'm going to talk about how we can do it and include our shadow side. So limitations of this truism. Well, for one thing, humans are evolutionarily hardwired to live in the past and the future. We don't have the instinctual ability that animals have. We have some instinctual ability. our reflexes and our instincts only count for so much. We're future-oriented beings. The past and the future are significant to us. And that's pretty important. That's about our survival. We can't learn without living in the past. And we can't plan without living in the future. Fears about the future are essential to motivate us to do something that's unpleasant. Sometimes we have to do unpleasant things to bring about a future that we care about. So years ago, when I was first asked to give a talk here, I was afraid. Since I was afraid, I really planned. The day after Katagiri Roshi asked me, I went home and thought about it for the whole day. Because I was afraid. I'm in front of everybody. I would give a talk about Zen. I don't think so. But that fear motivated me. It motivated me to plan, to repeat, to develop momentum. How many of us would have acquired an education if we hadn't had some fear motivation and some then idea that we wanted to do something? So fear is not negative always. It can be very motivating, and since we're oriented to these other two spheres. And not that there are really three separate spheres, but just pretending there are for now. Fear can be helpful, and our limitations can be helpful. So that's the first limitation. The second limitation is the limitation comes from the Zen that we started doing in the 60s, which came out of Beat Zen. And I call that the small now, in contrast to the big now. And that's not to criticize any of those guys, because if it weren't for them, we wouldn't be here. Guys like Jack Kerouac, I'm talking about. But anyway, the ethos then was, it be in the moment. Do the thing that makes you feel good, right? Be in the moment. Do what makes you feel good. God probably remembers that too, don't you, God? Those of us who are old remember that. Uh-huh. Impulse. Everything we did on impulse, and we kind of aggrandize it by giving it a spiritual, spiritual connotation. Eastern spirituality connotation. Let go of ego and just be in the now, right? Ram Dass's book, right? All that stuff. So that small now, that impulse behavior based on now, based on how I'm feeling, it ruins people's lives. It ruins people's marriages. makes it so people can't control their health because they're just in the now. And look at climate change. Boy, look at climate change, so focused on being in the now that we're not taking care of our own environment for 40 years from now. My goodness. My goodness. So our past is a clear indicator of our present circumstances. How have your last couple months been, you guys? Are you living today to give your tomorrow self something to build on? Based on what you're doing today, the choices you're making today? So that's the second limitation. Third limitation is, what is this now that we're supposed to be in or that we want to be in? What is it? The minute I say I'm in the moment's gone. What is this moment? What is this moment? The moment you become conscious of it, it's over. Oh, I'm here now. No, you're gone. You say that, right? And in Buddhism, in Buddhist thought, they talk about a moment being 1/75th of a second. And Kardigar used to snap his fingers. So the 75 of these makes up a second. I guess you really have to snap your fingers fast, right? And that's a kasana. That's a kasana. In each 1/75th of those, there are 900 arisings and seekings. Now you know, you think the Buddhists didn't have much to do, right? But that's what they say. There are 900 arisings and seekings in each of these. So what's the now? Where's the now? And when we live in the past in mind, we can consider how we want to remember our experience. As a result, we can live intentionally, right? We can live intentionally. 10 days or so ago, we had a meeting here of all the priests. And Ted, I see Ted's not here this morning. So Ted is leading. Ted is going to be my co-guiding teacher on January 1. And he's leading the kind of preparations for this capital campaign and doing this capital, going to lead the capital campaign. And I'm just trying to be quiet on the sideline and allow him to move into this role. But we have this meeting and oh no, I had to speak up. I had to speak up. And it came so fast. You know, these things come so fast, right? There I was just doing it. Just doing it. So, when I noticed it, I didn't even notice that I was doing it but then I noticed I'd done it, and a little while later I apologized. Whew! Whew! That helps to apologize. Even if you don't notice it for 10 minutes or 10 hours, it helps. It helps. And your practice can help you with this too. So, can we accept? And so having a memory was important. Now I have that memory of what I did with Ted. I'm remembering that. I'm remembering my apology. And so that's going to help me. Next time I'm in a situation with him and the group's together and I want to say, ooh, you know, I know what to say. I'm going to pause because I have that memory. That memory helps me. So we need to accept and value our evolutionary disposition to think the past is important as much as the present is, so that we can create futures that we really care about. I really care about a future where he's my co-guiding teacher, not just the ancillary one that I get to run over anytime I want. I care about that. But I'm also programmed, so I'm always trying to pay attention. Trying to pay attention. And we have pictures and memories of significant experiences from the past that help us move toward a future that we care about. So example I've used so many times. I have pictures in my mind of my brother when he was 10 and I was 20 and taking him on a hiking trip, and then I have pictures and memories of him committing suicide when he was 30 and I was 40, and those motivated me to, for the last 20 years before I'd retired, to try to create options in the community for people who were suicidal so they wouldn't have to get locked up, and so they could, you know, live in society, because when he killed himself, he was locked up. So those things can help us. Those memories can help us. So how do you want to look back on today? How do you want to look back on today? On this year? On your entire life? Your past informs your decisions you're making now. And better than acting based on impulse, circumstance, or emotional state is acting with some intentionality, right? Some intentionality. Our lives are the stories that we're writing. Our lives, and here's a quote, an anonymous quote from someone, which is in your program. The present, I don't know, maybe it's not in your program. The present moment is simply the pen on the pad, leaving an inky trail. You can't stop the pen from writing. This actually must have been done about 30 or 40 years ago before computers, right? Well, what's the story you want to be written? Our memories are our identity. How we feel, about our past determines our confidence in the present. My confidence as a Zen Buddhist practitioner comes from my memories of sticking with this practice over lots of years and finally doing well in my sitting. Not doing well in my sitting for years, but just sticking with it and cracking open from just this little confined self into something big, which is right here. So you might want to consider your 80th birthday party. Although my 80th birthday party is coming up pretty soon, so maybe I should be considering my 90th birthday party. Consider your 80th birthday party. What would you like your loved ones to say about your life at that party? What would you like to say them to say about your character and your contributions? What achievements would you want them to remember? What impact would you have liked to make in their lives? The end of our lives is framed by how well we remember, how well we look back. And of course, present and future really aren't distinct. We fail, succeed at one, and the other two are part of it. They're all impacted. And furthermore, we can alter our past. There is such thing as memory alteration. Memories are fluid. Memories are plastic. Memories are malleable. By practicing generosity, patience, loving kindness about some memories that are stuck in there that are really negative, or about how we're kind of pouring the negativity from those memories out to our significant others, by practicing that, we alter the memory. We all think they're fluid. The most traumatic event is still fluid. It's still fluid. That's called adding seeds into the storehouse consciousness in Buddhism. Fresh seeds. You've got these other seeds from the past, but you're adding some fresh seeds. You're planting some fresh seeds. And then those fresh seeds don't get rid of the other seeds, but they offer them a buffer, offer them support, take the negative energy out of them, and so that it expands into positive energy. And of course, sometimes we all live in the small now. Sometimes we break our commitments, I broke my commitment to Ted by, I didn't make that commitment that day, but I made it to him a few months ago. I said, I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to let you do this. And I broke my commitment. Sometimes we break our commitments. Sometimes we can't control our anger. Yeah. Sometimes we sleep in instead of going to the gym. Yeah. So that's okay. It's okay. But if we do this long enough, our life starts to suck, right? Our life starts to suck. As J.M. Barrie, author of Peter Pan, has said, the life of every man is a diary in which he means to write one story and writes another. So negative emotions from the past can be sometimes be good. The regret that I felt, and you know, I'm making probably more of this than, but I'm doing this because I'm giving a talk. But I did feel regret. The regret that I felt when I did that with Ted was good. It could. It helped me. It helped me remember so that I don't want to. So I won't do it again. It helped me remember. These emotions can help us remember to learn from our mistakes so we don't do them again. My teacher, Suzuki, when I was first with him and been with him for a little while, I asked him, what was the most important thing I should do in my Zen practice? And he said, get up in the morning and sit in Zazen. Oh, I tried that and that seemed okay, but I seemed kind of like, is that all? Get up and just sit in Zazen. So I asked him a couple more times. That's all he said. Get up and sit in Zazen. Then finally he said, well, come sit with me in Zazen. Come sit with me. So affected the whole course of my life. And our memories that we really care about, that really impact us, affect the whole course of our lives. And we can use our positive memories from the past. We all have some positive memories. We all have some positive seeds to build up momentum, to do the things we really care about, to create a future that we really want. We can all do that. It doesn't matter how much trauma we've had. We can do that. And if we can't find the memory, then we put a new memory in. I also used to do hypnotherapy, Ericksonian hypnotherapy. I would help my clients go back to the past, their traumatic past, and put a new memory in. It's not easy, but it can be done. It's been done many, many, many times. And we do that in Buddhism, too. So those are the limitations of being in the now. Now, let's assume that we're dealing with all those limitations well, you know. Now, how can we be in the present and accept the past and the future, make use of the past and the future? Well, I've got six little things here I'm going to talk about, which are on your program, and they will not be new to probably any of you. The first one, number one, is meditate. Meditate. So meditation helps us so we don't respond automatically, impulsively. So we recognize the spark before the fire, before the flame. Because on the cushion, we learn to recognize the spark before the flame. Then when we're off the cushion, it's a little bit hard to generalize, but it does generalize on its own after a while. We notice the spark before the flame. Or maybe we notice the flame before it's a conflagration, right? Before it burns the whole relationship up or the whole house down. That's meditation. That's what meditation does. Now, in the case with Ted, I didn't, and I've been practicing for many, 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 many years. I didn't recognize the spark before the flame. But I recognized the flame before it burnt the whole relationship apart. So sometimes that's all we can do, but that's pretty good. That's pretty good. If we could do that, it's cool. It's cool. This is what I'm feeling. And how might I respond? Taking that extra breath. This is how I'm feeling. How might I respond? That extra breath increases self-control, recognizing and fessing up to what's going on with us, not getting thrown by threats to self-esteem. So easily we get thrown by threats to self-esteem. Oh, I don't want to admit that I did such and such, especially in public, because you know I want to protect my self-esteem. But I can see that, right? I can just see that. I can laugh at myself or maybe cry a little bit because I've been practicing for so many years. My goodness, still doing this, Tim? But that's fine. A little laughter, a little tears. So mini meditation throughout the day when you notice it. Just breathing. The breath is always here. Always here. You don't have to find something. I got to go get my zafu. Here's your breath right here. You got it. So the first one is meditate, to be in the big now in contrast to the small now. The second is to avoid being clouded by memories or worry about the future. Savor the present. Savor. We forget to experience and enjoy what's happening now. So, a couple of weeks ago, my wife, Linda, made garbanzos for dinner. Garbanzos. Chickpeas, for those of you who don't know garbanzos, which we've eaten for years. And I tasted the garbanzos. And then before I had really tasted them, really savored them, I said, what happened to those creamy garbanzos you used to make? This is like 30 years ago. She made these creamy garbanzos. They were really good. And then I thought, oops. And I actually tasted these garbanzos, and they were just as good. And they were actually better because the creamy garbanzo was just an image. These were actually in my mouth. But I'd already said to her, what happened to those? I think I owe her an apology, too. It didn't occur to me that I owed her an apology until I prepared this talk. And she's out of town. See, it took me that long. But I'm going to tell her when I talk to her. Giving talks is a good way to open up your psyche, right? Clear out your psyche a little. So, research was done a couple of times. Subjects took a few minutes each day to actively savor something they usually hurried through, and they it elicited more joy, more happiness, and other positive emotions, and fewer depressive symptoms. Mark Twain says, I have known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened. Worry, by its very nature, is thinking about the future. Awareness of the present melts this away. The flip side, ruminating about the past, thinking bleakly about that, is just as difficult, bogs us down just as much. But when we're savoring, we can't be ruminating or worrying. We just can't. We can't do all three at the same time. So savor. The third, to improve our performance, stop thinking about it. This is what Suzuki called Zen beyond self-consciousness. Stop thinking about it. So my example that I've given a number of times in my book is learning to do the waltz for my daughter's wedding. I felt awkward. And I didn't like it at first. But partly that's because I had a memory of 40 years before, 40, 30, I don't know, trying to learn the waltz and my friends making fun of me. And I had that memory from adolescence. People are judging me. What do I do with my arms? I want to let go, but I can't because it looks ridiculous. I had that memory. But just through practicing, just through doing it over and over again, I was pretty much able to let go of that. In fact, actually, when it came down to the big event, it was just wonderful. It was just wonderful. The dance just danced. It just danced. So if we can let go and be in the moment in our zazen, how about beyond our zazen? How about other activities? Why not? But don't be too self-conscious about it. Just do the activity that you care about and keep doing it 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 till it does itself, right? Till it does itself. Thinking too hard about what you're doing makes you do worse. You know that. So let's focus less on what's going on in our minds and more on what's going on in the room. Less on our mental chatter and more on ourselves as part of something big, huge, that includes everything. Everything. All life. And let's witness the passing movie in our minds of feeling social pressures, chattering, and just come back and focus on our immediate experience without attaching it to our self-esteem. It's just a movie. Just a movie. And when we do that, when we focus intently on what we're doing, sooner or later we become unaware of the passage of time. And that's what's called flow. Our awareness merges with the action we're performing, and the activity becomes intrinsically rewarding. But we have to be motivated to do the action over and over. So it has to be one we care about. It should be one we care about. If it's not one we care about, find one we care about and do it in our heart of hearts. Until it just does itself. And the fourth way in which we can open up to this big now, it's always here, including the past and the future, if something's bothering you, move toward it. If something's bothering you, move toward it. When we lose a love, we fight our feelings. We fight our heartbreak. Or we deny them, or we repress them, or we run away from them. When my dog died, I did all those things. This was when I was in my late teens. I haven't had a dog since I was in my late teens, which makes me feel sad, but I won't get into that. My dog died. I didn't want to see any other dogs. I didn't want to talk about dogs because I didn't want to deal with the feeling. I didn't want to deal with the feeling. I wanted to move away from it. I wanted to protect myself. That's okay. That's okay. But negative feelings that we're running away from or repressing are still there. They're still there. So, and they can't be avoided. Resisting them only magnifies them. So in our Zen, we're moving toward them. We're not moving toward them as some kind of project, right? Tim said, I need to move forward, toward it, goddammit. Not that. Not that. We're just moving toward it as part of our practice. So my friend is heartbroken over his wife's early Alzheimer's. Overwhelmed by feelings of sadness and longing. And he said, I hate feeling this way. I want to make this feeling go away. Well, he's not a meditator or a Zen person, so I just tried to be empathic. But if he was a meditator, and if I knew him a little better, I'd say, oh, can you just be with that? Can you just see that? Can you just feel that? Both the primary emotion and the secondary emotion. The primary emotion is the sadness. The secondary emotion is I hate the sadness, right? I hate the sadness. Can you just be with that? That's our practice, isn't it? As much as possible, just to be with it. It's okay for me to feel this way. It's okay for me to hate feeling this way. It's okay, because it's what's here. And that depotentiates it, depotentiates power to interfere with our just ability to enjoy being. It doesn't mean you don't want to change. Embracing the feeling doesn't mean you don't act. People think Zen acceptance is about not acting. No. It helps you act. It helps you act. But it has to come out of your understanding of what's going on now. If you feel anxiety, can you identify what it's tied to? Your sadness, your powerlessness, maybe about your partner's bad health, maybe about your own bad health. Just be with it, and then choose what to do. Just be with it, and then choose what to do. Then your choice is not just reactive. It's really coming from something deeper than just your reactivity. So the fifth one, I'm doing six here. The fifth one, practice Walt Whitman. I am large, I contain multitudes. Practice Walt Whitman, one of the early 19th century American Zen masters. I am large, I contain multitudes. Multiple selves we have. They're on different shifts. One self on one shift, and taking it over to the next shift, you know, the night shift, the morning shift, the day shift, the 1962 shift, the 1984 shift, right? Different shifts. So the so-called self is a sum of my memories, my desires, my thoughts, my feelings. And I'm a different person than I was 20 years ago. We don't need to care so much about past regrets and future fears. Past and future selves are relatives of ours, but they aren't us. They're relatives. They're relatives. But they aren't us. There's a picture of me right after I was ordained by Katagiri Roshi in my office in 1978. Sometimes I look at that picture. I think, is that me? Well, no, it's not really me, but it's a relative. He's a relative. Yeah. I may blame my past self for mistakes made that affect my life today. I made mistakes with him that may affect my life. But that was a past self. I don't have to dwell on it. That was a past self. The emotion of regret doesn't need to turn into me bad. Me bad? Anyway, if you're me bad right now, I'm the next self. This afternoon, you don't need to be me bad, because then you've got another self, right? Well, isn't that pretty cool? Isn't that pretty wonderful? I might feel concerned, and I guess I do feel a little concerned, I wouldn't be bringing this up, about getting dementia in 10 or 15 years, as my father did. Oh. But that me 10 or 15 years ago from now is a distant relative. I don't know what it's going to be like, that relative is going to be like, who he's going to be, what his issues are going to be like, who he's going to be with. So I don't have to fret about that distant relative 15 years from now, 10 years from now. I can care primarily for my true self, the one that lives now. Can we do that? Can each of us do that? The one that lives now. And the sixth way that we can open up to big now is by beginner's mind practice. habit of always noticing new things. And always noticing new things. New constellations creates engagement, new ways in which we're coming together, in which we're seeing and feeling. Creates engagement with the present moment and releases all of this crud inside. Because we're here for the first time. For the first time I've given, you know, hundreds of talks, but never this one. Never with you guys here sitting like this, looking like this. Never. Wow, I feel lucky just to see you. I've never seen you like this before. It's true. Once we think we know something, we stop paying attention to it. How'd you get here this morning? Did you drive here in a haze? Or did you notice the pattern of kind of mist and rain? And maybe you noticed grimacing on it, but could you notice the grimacing too? And just be there with it? You brought your umbrella and you didn't know if whether you have to use it or not. And did you pay attention to that? And then when you go home, again, always an opportunity, right? Always an opportunity. So there was an orchestra leader, and I don't know who it was, and I can't remember the details, who said that when they were getting ready to perform publicly during the last rehearsal, he always had the members of the orchestra tell them that just before they went on stage, he wanted them to make it new by holding their instrument in a slightly different way, holding their page in a slightly different way, wearing slightly different colors in their clothes so that they keep it fresh, so it could be new. So those are my six kind of ways of encouraging you to do the big now, and then notice when you're doing the small now, and don't beat yourself up. Big now and the small now aren't really different anyway. I'll close with a story, which I've told lots of times, but probably not in a few years. So when the Zen teacher Muchi was dying, his students all gathered around his bed. And they gathered around his bed because they were told he was dying and they loved him and they were sad, but they were waiting for his last words or something, his last whatever, his last teaching. And he was just quiet, and they thought maybe he was comatose because he was so quiet. You know, and they just waited a long time. He didn't die when he was supposed to. You know, nobody dies when they're supposed to, right? But they just kept waiting and waiting and waiting. Finally, a squirrel screeched on the roof, and the teacher jumped up. Now, I don't know if this really happened, you know. These are apocryphal stories, probably. The teacher jumped up. He didn't jump up because he was prone. He went up like this, and he said, "It's just this. And nothing more." And then he died. Apocryphal Zen story, right? So, that's what I want to talk about today. And be glad to have questions or comments or anything else anybody would like to do. Well, not within limits. I haven't set the limits yet, but we'll see what you do before I see if I need to set them. Yeah.
So if I had heard your talk a couple of years ago, the old me, a distant relative of me.
Yeah.
Especially the first part where you're talking about, okay, so, you know, you don't want to go for those impulses. You have to have this awareness of what your action is going to cause.
Yeah.
So I would have taken that to be like, okay, I got to figure out what the right thing to do is.
Yeah.
I got to figure it out. What should I do?
Yeah.
What should I do? And then basically that was a big mental pattern for me.
Yes. Where Yes.
Not being a moment.
Yes.
Because I was always worried about what the
future. Yes. Yes.
Basically what you said in the newsletter about, like, you know, not using this moment to try to acquire happiness in the future. I was doing you know, but then I see what you're saying about, you know, going with that first impulse all the time. Obviously doesn't create, like, a good thing. So I found a third way, a middle way.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I don't know if this is what you would recommend.
All right.
You know, I'm from a Taoist background, so.
You're from a what background?
Taoist.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know. You could.
Well, we're Taoists too, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not me to talk about that. So, basically, you know, if I listen to myself very deeply and sort of get in tune with how I'm feeling and ask myself, like, you know, from a place of listening, like, what should I do, like, or what do you want to do, then I get, like, the message of what, you know, is coming from my inner being. I think it's coming from my spirit, from my body, from sort of my wisdom. And if I keep always noticing how I'm feeling, you know, being very present to how I'm feeling without judgment, then I seem to develop this intuition about, oh, I remember how I did this last time, what you were kind of talking about. I remember how I did this last time, and this is how I felt. And it just becomes this intuition that I can access in each moment. So then the next time I go to make a decision, I keep making better and better decisions because I have this storehouse of, you know, to draw on. It also includes, like, conscience. So, like, because of what I know about the environment, I would feel bad littering or not picking up litter that I see, or, you know, recycling. So
yeah.
It kind of includes that. So, like, all of that is going into that decision, you know. So I'm kind of consulting all the different parts of me so that we all come together to make a decision about what the best thing to do moving forward is based on what we want to feel. But that feeling is more of a deep feeling of what's going to make us feel good in a sustainable way.
Wonderful. She's my Dharma teacher. I've got a new Dharma teacher here. No, really, that's wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you. That's wonderful. And be careful when these things start turning into shoulds. Be careful. It's a slippery slope once they start turning into shoulds and should nots. But, you know, I should be. I don't think you come back. So you learned an important lesson, and then you self-corrected, and you're continuing to self-correct, and there's no end to it. So you're never going to get it down, you know. But what is there to get down? What is there to get down? Thank you. Other people. Yeah.
I'm kind of curious more about your stop thinking about performance. Do you have any examples in your own life of when you were learning a skill, for example, and you would maybe get a feeling of frustration during the initial beginning phase, and then you would kind of attach to that frustration, it would prevent you from making progress, but then you kind of broke the loop by being aware of that frustration and separated yourself from it and just kind of focused on whatever you were learning?
Well, the two examples I gave are dancing and doing meditation. Would you like me to talk about more about one of those?
More particularly, just maybe a concrete example from the dancing. Do you have it?
From the dancing. Okay, well, I had to take these waltz lessons. My parents, you know, when I was a teenager. And I hadn't practiced. I didn't know anything about sense. So that was just awkward and embarrassing. And I had to dance with a teacher, Miss Boone, because I was not good. And my friends laughed at me. I mean, not in front of her, because they wouldn't dare. So that then when I many years later, when Erin, my daughter, said, "You're going to have to dance at my wedding, and you're going to have to dance the waltz," I got profane, not with her, but to myself. Yeah, and but then I did it, and what I needed to do was first do it at home with my wife where I felt safe. So if you're going to do a new behavior that you have some negative residue from the past, do it in a safe place. And I practiced first in a safe place even before the lessons, and then between the lessons. Because in a place of safety, we can almost always let go of our angst. And once I could do it in a safe place, in my own living room, I could begin to generalize it to with a dance teacher who still reminded me of this other dance teacher from 30 years ago. And I didn't want to dance with her. but my wife was good, and I could do this with her. And I was able to generalize a little bit to the dance lessons themselves. Then I kept dancing at the dance lessons, and then I had to move on and dance with my daughter-in-law, not only with my wife. Well, that wasn't too scary. My daughter-in-law is not my wife, so I'm generalizing. You know, I'm moving out. And then finally with the teacher, and then finally at the wedding. And then by that time, self-consciousness is gone. But it's practice. It's practice. And you build up momentum through practice. And then you're able to not be self-conscious and just live your life. And
That's very helpful. Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else? Yeah. Jeff.
So this has been a difficult week.
Uh-huh.
13 people were killed.
Uh-huh.
11 in the synagogue.
Yep.
Two people when the people could not gain access to a black church.
Yep. Black people. Yep.
And then, of course, there's the pipe bomb business.
Yep.
And the caravan of women and children.
Yes.
Moving toward our border. While our president has ordered thousands of American troops. Have any comments about any of that?
Well, I think that's really sad. And I think we need to do our best to both empathize with people's pain and decide what activity we should do to try to bring our fellow human beings together. And I think each one of us has to go inside and decide how to best both embrace these emotions of fear, which most of us are feeling afraid. Even white privileged people are feeling afraid. Be with those feelings, embrace them, and then think about, discover, as she was saying, what the right action is for us. What the right action is. Yeah. And in a time that's really confusing like this, politically and culturally, it's very hard to just settle in and be present and with all the emotion that's just being sort of out there in the environment. But it's the same practice. It's the same practice.
Tim, I just wanted to, I guess this raises an awareness of something that's come to me from a meditation practice that was sort of a surprising benefit, I guess, that I didn't anticipate. Is that I think that it's very, very hard in your day-to-day life to separate, if I'm feeling anxious, what part of that am I manufacturing and what part of it is in the ether?
Uh-huh.
You know, around me, it's in the news. It's what people are talking about.
Yeah.
Or incidents that have been out of my control. And I have to say, one of the things I put on my list of things, this sort of sorting process, like, what part of this is mine to own and what part isn't?
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, just to even pose the question.
Yes.
What's mine and what's not mine.
Yeah, that's right.
It's been a really helpful way of using that pause to sort out, you know, where do I put my focus even?
Yeah, good. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, well, thank you very much.